stay tuned for the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show coming your way right now. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Tuesday. Beautiful sunny day in Santa Cruz, the kind of weather we dream of here. We get to live. Mrs. Future has been enjoying it with me out on the beach.
Yeah. It's really almost too hot to wear a mask.
Yeah. Just incredible. our price for this is to figure out how to fix the leaky faucet in the shower.
Ah. Yeah, such for that, a small price to pay. Learn right how the water works.
Yeah. Minor details, but still well worth the efforts. Plus, I'm learning a lot about plumbing and exchangeable cartridges and things.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Lovely having a home to fix, isn't it?
The joys of it all. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's interesting to see how things are opening up around town. We talked to Dave over at Pixie Deli, mm-hmm. and he's getting ready to get his outdoor tables going.
Oh, boy. Yeah. The slow march towards normal.
The real Del Mar Flats, in case you folks are familiar with that. A very popular tourist destination.
Pixie Plaza. It has been there since I was a little child. It's well known for its motto, which says, no shirts, no shoes, no shorts, no problem. Which means you can come right off the beach in your bikini if you want.
Servers with a smile.
Right.
Began the tradition of the previous owner going back many years. So quite a historical little place for us. And sadly, nearby, there was a building that just burned down.
The Rio de Flats. Yeah, it was the old bar.
An old bar. I've always seen it on the corner. I've never been in it. Right. Never saw it. It's just a building standing by itself.
Right.
Now it looks like it will be raised.
Yeah, well, it was a very old building. I've never been in there either in all these years.
Probably
it's
a lot
been
of
open,
history.
I think, probably, who knows, since the end of Prohibition. I don't know.
Take the overflow crowd after the cement ship finished its evening schedule.
Right.
Of fun and dancing and drinking.
Right. You hear those pages shuffling in the background?
Yes, I do. What are those? Is
That's our friend Bobby.
Oh, okay. Bobby's on the... Hey, Bobby, you're here.
You can hear my papers.
We hear everything.
Yes, you got to be, super aware when that mic's on.
Yes. Wow. Hey, there was just some really interesting news that came out of the UK today. It's really kind of dramatic. They have a new, it's a steroid, anti-inflammable steroid. It's called Texamethasone.
Texamethasone. That's easy to remember.
You know, Johnson came out, Boris Johnson came out and said, this is a game changer, actually. Yeah. And the great thing is, it doesn't cost very much. No,
I think... Is it a preventative? Is something you would take before you get to...
Well,
is this a virus treatment, right?
It's more effective in the later stages where you're actually in the hospital.
Okay.
And you're actually, if you're on a ventilator, it can really actually save your life.
Oh, well, very interesting.
Yeah. So it will save a lot of lives. For instance, if you were on a ventilator, probably 41% of the people would probably die if you're on the ventilator. But if you take this drug, it's down to 27%. So it's a dramatic increase in life, in saving of lives.
Yes, one more time, Bobby. What's the name of this drug?
Dexamethasone.
Dexamethasone. Dexamethasone.
Yeah.
Now, was it already a commonly available substance that found a new lease on life?
That's correct. So, it's already gone through a lot of testing. It was used for people with rheumatoid arthritis or to reduce inflammation. And so here it's actually reducing the cytokine storm and inflammation in the body.
And you said it was a steroid?
Yeah, it's a steroid. Yes.
What does that suggest to you?
It's a hormone that actually reduces other hormones that trigger this cytokine or inflammation response in the body. So it just kind of reduces kind of like cortisone.
I was thinking more that steroids, you got to watch how much you take of them. You know,
that's correct. Just like hydrocortisone, that's a steroid and is for arthritis and things like that, or to reduce inflammation. This is the same kind of way it works.
Okay. Well, very interesting. That's the big medical news this week?
It just came out this morning.
I guess the latest medical news this week.
Yes. There's no other drug so far that can even come close to the number of lives it can save. It's very dramatic.
Wow. Wow. Very good. Very interesting. Thanks. Now, I'm glad to see there's some progress here, because part of what I had been noticing, and I was just talking to Charlie about this before he left, before us on, was how it seems to be a bit of a messy scene all the way up and all the way down in terms of the way things are being handled by our species with this whole virus and now racism thing. It's affecting local government. It's affecting federal government, state government, relationships within families. These two things are cutting deep.
They are big stressors.
Yeah. Now, I wonder, you know, if it's, since it's affecting the entire species, I'm wondering if it might be partly connected to larger events that are happening in the universe.
Such as?
Let's say, for example, the Earth is about to cross a fold in the heliospheric current sheet.
Okay, heliospheric means surrounding the sun.
It's a vast, wavy structure in interplanetary space separating regions of opposite magnetic polarity.
Oh.
Opposite magnetic polarity.
Uh-huh, the north and the south.
Yeah, you know, we're talking to Charlie.
Heliosphere.
We're feeling the idea of a solar pole shift, and that's exactly what the sun does every 11 years. It shifts its poles going on and out. So I wonder if these larger cosmic events affect the electromagnetics of the planet. Biology is both electromagnetic and chemical processes. So bigger events could affect our electrochemical balance.
Well, that's a very interesting theory. I sure like to read up on
that. So I'm not saying the sun is doing it, but its sun is big enough to have an electromagnetic effect on us, is one of the things.
No kidding.
Yeah, and so is the Earth itself.
My theory about the sun, going back to ancient religions and worshiping Ra, the sun and everything, is that monotheism actually started as worship of the sun. Like, we only have one star that made all life happen on Earth, and that's our source, and that's our God, and it affects everything.
Yeah, I can see that. And then polytheism started, and we started worshiping the Earth, too.
That's right. And every emotion, and heroic humans, and then scary humans.
Well, if that's divine, what about that strange, glowy, silvery disc that goes by?
Yeah, right, and the moon, right, sure. Sure, let's make them all gods. Let's have equal gods under the sun.
No, just one, but the one that comes up in the day. Yeah, you never know.
I'm Monty Python prayer, oh God, you are so big.
I'm sure we've thought of all these things and more in the thousands of societies we've evolved since the dawn of man.
What's interesting is the sun is actually connected, well, there's a lot of theories that it's connected not only to the center of our galaxy, but with other star systems, and there are fluctuations happening, and actually, the solar system doesn't pass through the plane of the galaxy evenly. It kind of is doing this wave up and down, and it takes like 26,000 years. There's also the precession of the equinoxes, where the Earth is actually like a top that's like wobbling, and it takes 26,000 years for it to do one circle. So
amazing.
So there's a lot of things happening simultaneously, and as we're moving across the galaxy, there are other energies, and the solar wind produces this shock wave, but sometimes that shock wave is distorted. You know, when they have those Voyager spacecraft, they actually pass that shock wave, and there's this intense, it's a lot hotter than they expected. They thought it'd be cold between stars, but it's actually very hot. Relatively speaking. So yes, not only is the sun, but this planet.
There's galactic forces.
There's other forces.
Intergalactic forces. There's also forces in other levels of universe. It's interesting that we often associate the emotions with the cosmos as well. Like take astrology, for example, how it's connected with stellar alignments, different feelings, different types of people. intuitively, I think our ancestors understood how electromagnetics and the motion of these bigger forces can affect us. I just didn't think they knew exactly how.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a fascinating inflection point that we're at, where so much is happening, not just negatively, but positively too. And I hope to share with you this next hour and a half or so, or some of the more positive elements that are happening with these cosmic debris storms.
Let's just keep looking up. There's a lot to be learned. All right, we'll be right back.
So enjoy the solar sector boundary crossing, and we'll see you after the break. Hey, this just came up on my screen. I was about to delve into some more space news. Coronavirus face mask for 50 cents now. AirPods Pro fall to $219. Clorox wipes, $20. Gee, that seems expensive for the Clorox wipes.
Maybe it's a large box of them.
They don't say how much, yeah. But it could be that Clorox wipes are holding on to their value more than face masks.
I don't know. Maybe you should just go buy a jug of Clorox for less than a few bucks, less than $5, and bring some paper towels.
Yeah.
I just know that wipes are the bane of plumbers.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. If they get in the plumbing, there goes your clear
drain.
Locks
things up nicely sometimes. Mm-hmm. That ad came up while I was looking at SpaceX's Starlink project. It looks like they've got it up and running.
Starlink.
At least for a small number of testers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working on, right now, the user hardware. Once they have this constellation of satellites in low Earth orbit, we'll have internet over the entire planet anytime you want without it having to go through a local source. But how do you pick it up? You know,
The satellites are basically bouncing signals from the Earth back down to a larger footprint, right? Yeah.
And the idea ultimately is
how do you pick it up
directly in your cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need a device.
But before that, we have to have a couple of gadgets. Right now, at least at this point in time, we still need an infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they have an antenna system, a local receiver that kind of looks like a UFO on a stick.
I see.
Yeah.
Can it be mounted on a hat on your head?
It probably could. I bet it would give you away as a Starlink
total
user.
Nerd.
Yeah. So SpaceX wants to begin beta testing by the end of the year.
Oh, here's the tweet from Elon Musk. It will get even simpler. Just two instructions for Starlink. Plug in and point at the sky. Can be done in either order.
Yeah. Well, the problem is you still need something. You know, you build it into the phone, you won't need anything anymore. But yeah, that's point and shoot, basically.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who doesn't want something that looks like a scepter?
Well, I'm ready to sign up.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Should we do it on the air right now?
Well, go ahead, Bram.
Yeah, it's supposed to be even better than actually getting your ISP like Xfinity or Verizon or something like that coming, because it's so much easier. You just stick this in the ground and you have the wire go to your phone or your computer and you're up and running instantly. You know, I think it's supposed to cost as little as $80 a month and you're supposed to get a gigabit down and also almost a gigabit back up.
It's symmetric signal.
It's a symmetric, well, close to symmetric.
Gigabit down and up, so
that's an optimal. And it's actually better
to 5G when you start getting in that realm. My goodness.
Yeah, so it's going to actually completely make 5G not as useful. You know, there's definitely some competition.
Yeah.
It's most effective in rural areas because in high concentrated cities,
it takes more infrastructure to cover large areas. You know, you get more bang for your buck with your investments in cities if you're an ISP.
But
for Starlink, though, it doesn't matter because you're just sending a signal from space. You can be anywhere.
That's right.
Like with the satellite TV today, you know, that's why it's so popular in the Midwest.
So you don't need a dangerous, tightly situated, located antenna system?
No.
You just need your device.
Well, you need a little gadget to plug into your device.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could go camping, you know. You could be in a park or it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, RVs have satellite dish antennas that move to, you know, track.
Yeah. You know. And you're going to see all the airlines have what this on top of their airplanes and all the cruise ships.
Right.
You know, it's going to be so much better
internet.
You can just
fish for signal wherever you are.
Gigabyte symmetrical. My God.
Yeah. It's going to be a game changer for sure, and change people that are in rural areas that, you know, never had high speed internet, or they'd have to spend an arm and a leg just to get it.
Yeah,
you know?
To get a dial up modem.
I always think of the Earth as this being, like this big head, right? This being that is growing a new layer to its brain, right? So the planet has all these new ways of thinking. And the latest one is from this satellite network that's going up into the atmosphere, sort of like the aura level of the Earth. And all of these satellite devices are going to be new synaptic centers of communication and thoughts and nodes.
Of the digital nervous system.
Of the digital nervous system of the unified, cohesive planet.
It seems to be acting like it's alive.
Yes.
So perhaps a nervous system is the best analogy for this.
Yeah.
Electromagnetic, moving us around, connecting with us, allowing us to be in touch with each other anywhere on the planet at any point. Really cheap.
But the thing that I,
if not free,
believe is that the intelligence of the Earth is asking for this expansion of sensibility.
Species connectivity?
Yes.
This really? You think the
ability
pays attention
to have more information that can be integrated with intelligence to invent new things. I think that the kind of intelligence that we humans are helping the Earth to accumulate is something that makes the planet smarter and
the planet likes
ideally
us for that.
More enhancing of the life that's here. It's meant to be a benefit, not a curse.
Yes, and nature will reward us when we get it right.
Yeah. Yeah, if it's done with love, if it's done with the sensibilities that come from our hearts and our passions and our joys, then all of these things will be art that...
Reflected in the invention.
Yeah, it will be embodied.
That's kind of like some of the visionary thoughts of the formation of the internet. Mm-hmm. In a way, you know, it's like a continuation of that dream of freedom, if you will.
Sure. Yeah. So we've gone from the cloud to, we need a new name for the satellite layer that's above the clouds, right?
It's, well, that'll be an episode in our KSEO TV show.
Yeah. It's more like the web of Indra, you know? It's a different layer of the Earth's auras, the stratosphere. Maybe we can call it the Stratusnet. Or it's above the stratosphere. I don't know the name of the layer that these satellites
are
in.
Low Earth orbit.
Okay, so L-O-L-E-O. Yeah. So yes, yeah, the leosphere.
Yeah.
I think that we're getting closer to what Dr. Michio Kaku was talking about, a type one civilization, where all connected as one.
Mm. Right. A planet that isn't bent on annihilating our own species.
Yeah. So we're actually connected rather than seeing as other parts of the world as being very far away and foreign.
I think that's the real story. I think that the centrally owned broadcast news media is governed by people who just live in fear, uncertainty, doubt, despair, and try to profit from it. And anybody who's using that as their source for what's really going on is getting this really slanted picture. And everywhere else in the world, spring is here and the Earth is celebrating and there's all kinds of opportunities to feel good, but you fill your time with this fixation on what's wrong, and then you don't have time to appreciate how great everything else is.
While everything else is turning to manure.
Well,
the phoenix rising from the ashes is the way I look at it. That's the mythology more of the time. A new society is arising from the old. In real time, one is transforming into the other. And it's an energy shift. And we can ride that wave.
Yeah. Be right back.
Oh, Okay, welcome back to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show with Bobby Wilder on the line here. We mentioned briefly the type 1 civilization that we're heading towards with the internet becoming ever more powerful and becoming a way of connecting us up like we can hardly imagine. It's going to create a planetary civilization, and that's what's been called the type 1 civilization. Originally by a Russian named Nikolai S. Kardashev in 1963, a Russian astrophysicist. And he spoke about it as a point in our evolution where we're able to harness the energy of the home planet and the energy reaching the planet, like solar, and all the energy it can produce, thermal, hydro, wind, I guess gas and oil would be part of that too, described it as having technological level close to the level presently attained on Earth back in 63. So we're close to him suggesting that we are about to become a true planetary civilization. However, physicist Michio Kaku, who Bobby mentioned, thinks a planetary civilization should also be able to control things like earthquakes, the weather, volcanoes, that we won't be a true planetary intelligence until we can do that sort of thing.
Well, the idea of controlling those things is really a big leap. How about the idea of understanding those things? Why don't we
let go of this need to fix
things that aren't broken? And
control is a male thing anyway.
Listen, pay attention, notice, understand.
Yeah, okay, you got a point there. You can bring in the feminine. Well, actually, that's good because the feminine would probably speed this up. We don't have to learn how to control earthquakes and the weather and volcanoes to have a balance.
Right. You need to learn to speak the language of Earth and understand when Earth creates a volcano or when there's an eruption from a volcano. What is the Earth saying? Why is the Earth doing that? And when you understand all the planetary forces, you'll see that it's a natural cycle.
Well, that's what our ancestors do. They would send out the shaman and talk to the volcano, see what they came up with. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess sometimes they said move away or put somebody in it to appease them, the gods.
Yeah, you gotta realize that those guys are probably just guessing.
Yeah. Well, you never know. Maybe they do talk to the volcano gods.
Yeah, well, anytime you're speaking a language, there's room for misinterpretation.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that if a lot of people hear the same message, it's a little more believable. Mm. But even that, we have fake news today where millions of people believe millions of messages that are often contradictory to each other.
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Yeah, well, free will universe. Anybody can believe what they want. It doesn't have to be coherent. It doesn't have to be absent of contradictions. But the wiser you are, the more tuned in you are with the bigger reality.
Well, according to the civilization scale here, we're on our way. Once we reach this level of awareness, well, balance and connectedness to the universe, then we want to become an interplanetary civilization and evolve beyond this planet and be able to make use of the total energy potential of our star.
The total energy
potential
of our star. We're so tiny compared to
that. And that's when we
become
a type 2 civilization at that point. That's right. More like we're closer to where Star Trek and Star Wars and Live more, where interplanetary travel is nothing.
Hmm.
Oh, it's something, but it makes it part of the fun.
Right. Well, if we could tap even just enough power to manifest all of the desires we have, there's certainly plenty of energy coming from the sun for us to use efficiently to make things happen.
And to be able to have a interplanetary, all the planets are inhabited, and we have a network of trade and connection, and everyone's different, and we all get along, mostly, except maybe in the asteroid belt.
Sure. Yeah, wouldn't it be interesting if there was a way to terraform Mars so that it could be warm?
We're very clever monkeys. Many people have thought about that and have all different. You're probably familiar with terraforming, Barbie, right?
I try to do that in my garden,
There you go.
A microcosm, macrocosm, yeah.
A humble experiment on the right track.
Yeah, there's definitely some interesting scientists. Even Elon Musk believes we should be able to start producing or changing the atmosphere of Mars where it might be breathable. There's a lot of sci-fi movies on that.
Yeah, I think the Schwarzenegger film, 1990.
Terminator? Oh, no, no.
The Mars movie.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking
about. Total Recall.
Total Recall.
Right.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah. See, that was in playing with the inner worlds and the balance of our minds with actual Mars, with actually traveling to places. You know, did Arnie actually hallucinate this whole journey to Mars, or was it real? Was it part of the implanted memory vacation, or was it something else?
Or was it the Matrix?
You know, was it the Matrix? Right. It's getting complicated here. I'm glad I live in Santa Cruz and got sores and experienced the trees for a while.
Yeah.
Once we have this planetary intelligence, then we'll become a type 2 civilization and know how to work with the entire potential of a star. And that's their example for that level of intelligence would be to create what's known in science fiction lore as the Dyson Sphere.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
A giant sphere that would surround the entire sun, special type of material. And this sphere would capture all of the energy of the sun. I guess it would have to be like made out of black hole material or something.
Well, you just imagine something that's probably already there that we don't perceive, because the sun is putting out this endless wave of energy all the time.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of energy going out from the sun.
The thing that it's creating around itself has so many different kinds of structures to it. I mean, the solar system being just one of them. This imaginary Dyson sphere being an energy
suck
area. No, an area where a certain amount of energy is harnessed.
Yeah.
Probably is actually what the planets are using to maintain their motion
around the sun. Everything is. So, first of all, it'd probably be ecologically, have to be designed properly, not to interfere with all the processes of the planets in the solar system that you're building your Dyson sphere in. Right.
You're always acting like you're creating something that's separate and new and doesn't already exist, which means that you're missing
what already exists. Well, you know, humankind must create in its own way. You know, it's a little different than nature.
But you know that it's a holographic universe, that everything is already affecting everything else and is present in every point.
Yes. Yes, I guess it's perhaps the desire to create something with that awareness.
Hmm.
And that will evolve as I understand my connection with nature deeply.
Mm. Ah, yes. Good thing to study. Again, back to the garden.
Me a good grasshopper. Okay, well.
There was a couple years ago, they were trying to explain why some of these stars had varied energy levels coming out.
Yeah.
And one of the proposals was they were building a Dyson sphere around this one star, and occasionally it wasn't complete, and so there would be openings, and that's why we were seeing these sudden blasts of energy that couldn't be explained any other way.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
So there is a star, and some life force has built a spaceship around it, but that spaceship has some holes, some windows that let the internal light shine through.
An artifact of the Dyson
otherwise
sphere.
Otherwise wouldn't be able to get out.
An artifact. Yeah. Like we understand artifacts of non-existent comet science fiction inventions. And we see evidence for them.
Sure.
If we look, well, that brings up the idea of when you think from a certain way, you believe a certain thing to be true, does that make it true? You start collecting evidence to support that and ignore evidence that doesn't. Do you do that?
Confirmation bias.
Yeah, are we all guilty of that?
We do see through lenses that support our beliefs.
And the social contract we have with each other is to figure out what's real and what's not. Because it can all be real if we don't have that feedback loop. Anyway, you have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. We've got a couple of folks who want to chime in here.
All right.
Let's talk to Mark from Watsonville.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
I got a question. There's reading in the news, and this is just the newspaper, there are four asteroids going by the Earth, close approach to the Earth this month, and they're traveling along at 50,000 miles an hour. They said the closest one will get 300,000 miles close to the Earth. Is that considered close,
300,000? Well, it's like the moon, right? The moon's 250,000 miles, so just a little past the moon. It's relatively close, but it's pretty far, really.
Well, I don't know on the relative of space.
if the solar system is a pool table, then you're not going to hit another ball.
But still, it's
okay.
You know, I think it gets a little more scary when they're between the Earth and the Moon.
Okay, they said it's 120 feet long. It's going 50,000 miles an hour. Now, if it hit the Earth, would that be a catastrophic effect, like wiping out the dinosaurs, or not that big of a deal?
Depends on what angle it hit and where.
It would be bad.
It could glance off the atmosphere. There's a lot of things. We'd have to calculate it out, and it's not an easy issue, and certainly one of the big things to look out for. However,
the one that ended the dinosaurs that landed, in the Yucatan, that was much larger.
I think it was a couple miles across, isn't it?
Oh, okay. Or,
yeah, but 100 feet, that would wipe out a city, probably.
That would.
If it was a direct hit on a city,
yeah.
Or create a tsunami.
Is this common? It said four this month, this close, so I don't know. Is that a common event, or is it newsworthy, or don't worry about it?
I would say not worry, but it's that we have better sensors now. So you're going to hear more of these things, and it's going to sound like, oh, it's happening right now, but we just have better sensors.
We have better sensors for detecting more of them, which is great, just like we have better testing for COVID, which is great. And so naturally, we'll see more of them. But whether or not it's more dangerous, who really knows? But we're watching, at least.
Be right back. Heading for a break.
Okay, a little internet check while we went to break. How many potentially hazardous asteroids are there? Best answer I found so far was about 1,500 asteroids.
That are currently being tracked.
Currently documented as having the potential to cause serious damage. They're the ones we know about.
So those are ones we know about that are coming close enough to pay attention to.
Yeah, we start looking at them when they get to about 7.5 million kilometers from Earth, and whose brightness indicates they're at least 100 meters, 300 feet across.
And how often do we have to worry about those 1,500 coming close enough?
Well,
is it once a year, once a month, once a century?
Somewhere between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 10,000 years.
Okay.
Yeah, depending on how severe you're talking about.
Yeah, it really only has to happen once to really wreak havoc.
Yeah, approximately. But, we don't know when that's necessarily when the next one's going to happen. Anyway, do we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
Yes, very patient. WC in Santa Cruz, welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you very much, guys. All this talk about the electricity and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Instead of all these solar farms, what about Nikola Tesla's wireless electricity?
Hmm. Wireless transmission of power. And one of his great inventions that never made it to the light of day for some reason. They say it was the electricity wars that kept it between Edison and Tesla.
I think it was Westinghouse.
Westinghouse was his buddy. Westinghouse was Tesla's friend.
But Westinghouse didn't want to give out the energy for free, and Tesla did.
That's a big difference with your partner.
Yes.
One's a business, and look what happened to Westinghouse. It kind of worked, But
I think Tesla thought of it as a hardware business, right? You just have to go out and install your Tesla pole.
Yeah.
It's not a toll road where you keep charging people over and over again.
Wireless seems like a great idea.
Yeah.
And we get rid of all these bureaucrats, like the state of California controlling what PG&E can and can't do, like going to diesel instead of natural gas to keep the electric supply going.
Yes. I think it would be possible to follow what Elon did with putting the internet in low Earth orbit and put wireless power units in low Earth orbit. And they could be sent to anywhere on the Earth instantly. We should be able to do that kind of dream with low Earth orbit. I mean, we translate the abundance of solar energy up there into electromagnetic waves that can be picked up on the Earth and turn into heat and light and power. Mm. So we should be able to do that. It's certainly possible, but it would require a focus, a big focus of our species to do something along those lines. Did it go back to the original ideas of how Tesla himself transmitted power? Well, from my understanding, I talked to one scientist who had studied that, and he said that Tesla was using voltages and power levels and frequency ranges that would destroy a lot of our modern equipment. A lot of our electronics would not be happy with the frequencies that the wireless transmission of power Tesla technologies would use.
And that would put a lot of people, new jobs on redesigning the equipment.
Yes.
To handle it.
That's true.
Sure.
We wouldn't have those little electrical outlets in the walls anymore. We'd have some like antenna on the roof that picked up our power.
Really? Or what about the idea of instead of spacesuits, you could have Earth suits and they would, you know, you'd walk around and they would automatically power themselves from the electrical grid and you could just use the interface on your sleeve to access the internet.
Well, it's not so far off. I think Tesla's original idea was to stick two poles in the ground. So it was earthing. It was an earthing technology rather than an atmospheric technology.
And besides a heavy, instead of a bulky suit, we can transform our tinfoil hats into antennas to collect it.
Now you're talking. I knew there would be a tinfoil hat in there somewhere.
A useful tinfoil hat.
Yeah, but no, I'm a great fan of Tesla. He was a great man, and he got shafted.
Yeah.
Like at the World's Fair, he got the contract for his alternating current, and they refused to sell him electric light bulbs.
Mm.
So he had to design his own in a matter of weeks so that he could light the fair.
That was the Chicago World's Fair?
Right.
The Chicago Exposition. Yeah. It was amazing. That was, understand, that was this lights were a main feature that is remembered to this day from that fair.
Yeah, and they screwed him on those because they were more efficient than the other bulbs that were on the market at that time.
He had an amazing mind. My understanding is that he often saw an invention to its completion in his mind before he even started soldering.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of his stuff is still used today.
And he spent many years inventing electromedical devices, which we don't hear much about today either.
Yeah, he was the inventor equivalent to Einstein, seeing stuff in his mind and then making out the formulas.
Yes. Yeah, very practical inventor.
Exactly.
Yeah, less of an academic in that sense. Fascinating. Well, good. Well, good to talk to another Tesla fan. Thanks for calling him.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye. Yeah,
you bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, as I was saying, 1,500 asteroids. Maybe Tesla had an invention that would stop an asteroid. You know, like some electromagnetic pulse or something that could slow it down or change its course. I guess if it were metal, if the asteroids were metal, you could use electromagnetics to move their thing. What do they use in the movies? Nuclear bombs? I understand that's not a great idea with asteroids because it breaks them up into smaller pieces, which could cause like a multiple warhead on the Earth. Not good.
Yeah, wasn't the movie Gravity basically about that?
I think, you know, the Starlink by Elon Musk, they actually have plasma propulsion on those satellites. And it doesn't take very much, but it's just it's an ion energy. And so instead of propellants and fuel, it's this plasma. I know that DARPA had these projects where they would transfer energy using lasers. If you're up in the stratosphere,
I've heard about that.
You can actually transfer energy via lasers because there's no air up there, and so you wouldn't get this loss through the air.
Electromagnetic frequencies, I think, in the microwave range. Yeah, and they can both handle power. I also got a note. Thanks, Richard. Everyone have small solar panels on their roofs. That's decentralized power. Share and sell the power in your neighborhood. Another model. That's eminently practical, Richard. But we're talking about
imaginary things.
No,
impractical
it's not.
Things. No,
Tesla invented Tesla invented this stuff, where we haven't used it.
Unimplemented.
Yeah,
things.
Wireless power. I think if people are freaking out about 5G right now and just electromagnetics and relatively low wattage range, transmitting power is going to freak out a lot more people. You know, from a psychological point of view, because it's going to be, well, how much power is that? Well, it's a lot of power. It's enough to power a city. Yeah, does that have an effect on my biology? Probably. You know, I can only imagine. But yeah, no doubt. So we'd have to study that. Or as you were saying, lasers might be a better answer than microwaves, because they can be tightly beamed to a location and not be across the entire environment, like the radio waves. So, yeah, laser transmission of power from low Earth orbiting satellites, I think, is a very doable idea.
In the cards. Yeah. In the future.
Yeah. I believe that transportation follows communication and technological innovation. So we're, like we saw, the internet is connecting up everybody for communicating with each other and connecting. And now we're seeing the autonomous trucks and cars suddenly come in, and they'll form a network, packet-switched network, much like the digital
information. Now that
nobody's
going out,
molecules
huh?
around.
Now that everybody's sitting in front of their screen, the autonomous cars can go wherever they want.
You know, we've got to follow our true nature and not necessarily have to commute 2 hours a day, you know, to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, we want to be happy beings as part of our constitution. So how do we maximize that and our society as well? And that's the magic. And you see that we can create. These technologies, if used consciously, can create massive amount of abundance and wealth and happiness for all of us. That, I think, makes it worth what sometimes seems like a Faustian bargain to create these inventions.
It's the last minute of the first hour here.
Okay.
Focus on outer space. So, this is the Dr. Future
Rocket Show. Lab. I didn't even mention Rocket Lab.
There's so many things you haven't mentioned yet. You have this amazing slate of headlines.
Virgin Orbit.
Can't wait to talk about.
Yeah.
All right, this is KSCO Santa Cruz.
And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, welcome back to this beautiful day in Santa Cruz. Hope it's wonderful wherever you are. Some more news at the top of the hour.
Space news.
Space news, yes.
What's happening
Dr. Mrs. Future News.
Inner space.
Virgin. Virgins in space.
Virgin Galactic.
Yes, Sir Richard Branson. They decided to try a new business besides just taking passengers up into space and back.
Yes.
And that is to launch satellites into low Earth orbit. There seems to be a lot of need for low Earth orbit satellites these days.
Well, that's where the money is. Space cargo.
Space cargo, yeah, get it there. So Sir Richard Branson got a Virgin Orbit company, and he did a test launch rocket over the Pacific. And in their design, they have a big airplane that carries up a rocket and then drops the rocket at 40,000 feet, and then the rocket launches and goes the rest of the way into space and launches the satellites from there. So it's a two-stage process where the airplane does the heavy lifting up to 40,000 feet. It almost worked.
Yes?
Yeah. The rocket fired, but it didn't fire on time.
Oh.
Yeah, so timing was everything.
Oh, so what happened?
It crashed in the ocean, yeah.
It crashed in the ocean.
So
it missed space by a mile.
So what went wrong? They're trying to figure out exactly why the staging didn't work the way it's supposed to. But that's what you figure out. You know, when you're inventing new technology, you've got to, and in rocketry especially, timing is so important.
Absolutely. Well, and I heard that Elon sent a tweet that said, getting to space is hard.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sure you learned a lot. Better luck next time.
He says, well, first of all, Virgin Orbit says, we're excited about the data we're able to get today. You know,
right.
So they see the inside of it. Such thing as a failed experiment.
You know that, right? Yeah. You were in a rocket club when you were in high school, right?
Yes, I was.
And basically, every time you fire a rocket, it may or may not happen.
Yeah. You'll learn something.
And you'll learn something and make it better.
Exactly.
Right.
And Elon said to Virgin Orbit, he said, sorry to hear about that. Orbit is hard. Took us four attempts with Falcon 1. Four attempts. So the first one.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Virgin Galactic, they do keep trying. They keep coming back. Right? They've had more famous failures than some of the other folks.
Yeah, and they're likely to have the passenger flight thing down. Virgin Glad with Richard Branson, with what he knows about airlines and customer service.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And such.
Yeah, trying to go from airlines to space liners is a big step.
It's a big step, yeah. And it's a risky venture, to be sure. But, you know, I mean, if you're in his position, that'd be a fun thing to do.
Sure. And he did win the X Prize. He was the first one there. He was the first one to be able to take a vehicle out of the atmosphere twice, right?
That Virgin Galactic's really one of the winners.
Yeah.
I think they'll pull through on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Meanwhile, up on the moon, it's funny, we were talking about solar energy earlier. It turns out that not only is there a fair amount of water on the moon in the craters, but also there's a tremendous amount of solar energy constantly hitting the planet. Right? Just all the time. The moon.
This is not news.
It's not news, right? It's obvious. But they're realizing that as we get really good solar panels, that this could power everything.
Oh, yeah.
And
right.
There are areas on the moon where it's like sunny all the time.
Sure. And so the big focus of the Artemis mission of NASA is to cultivate all of that
energy,
solar power, to have a moon base.
Oh yeah, easily. I would imagine that it would also be a source of energy that could be used for anything that they could beam that energy to. Because we will, mark my words, we will get into the wireless transmission of power one way or another. Mm-hmm. Because it's the best way to, who's going to put wires everywhere in the universe?
Yeah, well, especially how much everything costs in terms of weight getting it to the moon. You want to use what's already there.
Yeah, it's already in place.
Right.
It's already using it.
And there's no wires on the moon so far.
No.
Not much. There's some old scraps from failed missions and
we're
stuff.
Getting a lot of power from the sun and it's wireless.
Yeah, right.
To get it this far, how did it do that?
we didn't used to call it wireless before. No. We were so dependent on our wires.
No, wireless purely meant radios. I heard them on the wireless. Yeah, fine time we're in with this.
Yeah, I believe that electricity experiments started out originally from trying to understand sparks, like the kind of shock you get when you walk over a carpet and you shock yourself when you touch something.
Yeah.
That was the original non-wireless transmission.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. We didn't have an invention that collected that static electricity from your clothes. Van de Graaff generator, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh. Van de Graaff generator, yeah.
Yeah, you remember those, Bobby?
Yeah, my neighbor had one. And if you touched it just right or put your hand on it and then turn it on,
yeah,
you didn't get the spark, but your hair would stand up on it.
That was impressive. That was definitely spawned a whole generation of monster movie heads, hair design.
So you have hair like Einstein. You
know? Yes. Is Bobby having an idea? Yeah, I remember. I love those things. They were very low wattage, very low current on them.
That's right.
So you could take a lot of voltage, and 100,000 volts, but it was extremely low power. So you could take that. But
did you ever try that?
Yes. Yeah. Oh,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so
in Philadelphia, they had the Franklin Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Franklin Institute had a giant Van de Graaff generator. They loved to rev it up and shock the kids, so to speak. The kids loved it.
Al, do you remember at Burning Man, they had those huge ones?
Oh, yes. Took it to another level entirely.
Yes.
I'm starting to understand why you guys are such biohackers when I now see what your early roots are.
Ah, yes.
You want to plug yourselves into electrodes.
It's watching Dr. Megawatt do his thing for hours.
That's right. Dr. Megawatt.
He had two huge Tesla coils.
Yes.
And he would stand between them.
In his suit.
He had a special
spaceman suit.
And conduct a whole symphony of sparks between the two and himself as the conductor is something to behold.
Yeah.
More after the break. There's something I want to say about hummingbirds. I think quite fascinating.
We'll be right back.
What you see, 9 to 5.
So what's that program called, Mrs. Future? I seem to be sharing my life with you and this program that you're constantly
giving
your attention.
You're talking about my addiction to my computer game?
Yeah.
Yes, it's called The Clockmaker.
The Clockmaker.
Yeah.
Now, what makes it so exciting for you? Why do you spend untold hours looking at The Clockmaker?
Well, I really like the colors and the game. You know, I mean, it's just a little Candy Crush kind of game. Uh-huh. But I like the setting of it. The artistry in which the game is set has all of these lovely characters that are representative of the people behind the game. And so I kind of feel like I'm supporting their art and getting their novel and getting the characters' stories, and you know.
And you saved a couple of towns, is that what you're saying?
Yes, I've saved a couple of towns now in Clockville.
She has another parallel life here. I never knew. Are you married over there?
No. But I'm everybody's friend.
Oh,
they all ask me to help them on their various adventures.
Oh, like you are somewhat knowledgeable of territory, huh?
I'm just there helping them.
Okay.
Helping them save their town.
So I wanted to mention something about hummingbirds.
Yes, do that.
It turns out that they have an extra cone in their
chromatid.
Eye. Chromatid it is called. It allows them to see colors that are outside of the human domain entirely.
Mm. That's very interesting, since they're, to us, their colors seem so magical and mystical and effervescent, right?
Yeah.
They have that shimmery color quality that you can't quite pin down. That green turning to gold, turning to red.
Ultraviolet.
Oh, the ranges
that they're able to see outside of outside of the human realm. They says we don't even imagine.
Not only does having a fourth color cone type extend the range of bird visible colors into the UV, it potentially allows the birds to perceive a combination colors like ultraviolet green and ultraviolet plus red. But this has been hard to test. I quote your article.
Yeah. It says like
they did a really interesting experiment to try and see if they could.
Well, how do you figure out
in
what
the hummingbirds?
That's right. How do you test the hummingbirds out? From my understanding is that they had these special painted little signs they put in front of a hummingbird feeder. It'd either be the hummingbird feeder, they'd be filled with sugar water, or it would be water. And knowing that they would prefer the sugar water.
So they put a sign up like, so this is sweet water over here.
But the color could only be seen on the sign if you had the superpower to see ultraviolet.
Right.
And if you could, then you knew where the water was automatically and just automatically get it right,
mm-hmm.
which they apparently learned to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what does this mean? I'm sure it's just the tip of the iceberg that birds, and it's not just hummingbirds, a lot of birds can see these extra colors, are tracking things we have no idea are even there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty amazing.
You know, there's like 7 people in the world.
Yeah.
That have this tetrachromatic visual system.
7 people?
They've documented only 7 people.
Oh,
because
actually
it's
humans.
Very. What it is, it's a gene to produce special red chromatid. So instead of just the 3 chromatids that are the cones that are in your eyes, they have a 4th one.
People. And you're talking about people having hummingbird eyes.
Well, they're not in the ultraviolet like the hummingbird. They have an extra one in the middle, in the yellow region.
Oh.
I think lobsters, there's certain sea animals that have this color chromatid also. And what they can do is they make perfect interior designers, because when they look at a rainbow, instead of just seeing 7 gradations, they see thousands of gradations of color, and they're able to check out color like no one else. Just these 7 people can do this. I imagine if you could see in the ultraviolet, then yes, you would see. First of all, it's great for flowers, because flowers,
sure.
if you can actually distinguish colors of flowers in the ultraviolet. They reflect in the ultraviolet. So I think that's why they
have this. Yeah, I understand plants. You can see more variations in plants of all kinds, flowers especially. Bird plumage also. Mm-hmm. Apparently you'll see more variations in bird plumage if you can see in ultraviolet.
What's interesting about their plumage is it's not that the color is a pigment in the feather. It's actually the diffraction grating of the color, and that's why it shimmers when it moves.
Because it's a multiple color, so?
Well, you're seeing it through prisms, like different diffractions of...
Diffracting the color.
It diffracts the color. So it's not a pigment. It's not a solid color. It's just light being diffracted. Oh. And that's why you see this shimmering effect.
The rainbow effect.
Yes.
So I guess that extra cone helps them to really see each other with much more variety.
That would be interesting too, yeah. So I think if you get these like Nikon cameras that can do ultraviolet, and a lot of people that are taking pictures of UFOs, apparently they're in the ultraviolet spectrum. And they have a cloaking device in the visible spectrum.
Yeah.
And so certain cameras can see between
the dimensions.
Yes, and see these extra-dimensional, well, they're not extra-dimensional.
Ultraviolet.
Ultraviolet spacecraft, yeah.
Ultraviolet high-speed, low-light technology.
Yes, yeah, so I think the hummingbirds can see the UFOs and we can't.
Explains a lot.
That's where they learn to fly, I guess. They have a connection with the hummingbird aliens. Speaking of which, there was an interesting study that kind of ties into the what you might have heard of as the Drake's equation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. About how many alien civilizations are there in the Milky Way?
Oh, you're jumping right away into a new section here.
Well, it's connected.
Yeah. You know, the Drake equation and the tetrachromatic hummingbird eye.
Long distance.
That's quite a leap.
Long distance is a different thing when you have these portals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's some science behind it. They've come up with how many civilizations are actually in the Milky Way that are advanced like us.
Oh, now I understand. It's the alien connection.
Yeah, the alien connection. Okay. And, you know, one of them is probably the hummingbird aliens.
Oh.
But there are 36, according to this.
The Drake's equation predicts 36
alien... Well,
beyond
the Drake's equation, it's a...
extraterrestrial species in our galaxy.
Yeah, given a number of... Of course, there are a number of things they might have wrong about making certain assumptions. But making reasonable assumptions, 36 aliens right now, that they would exist right now.
Oh.
So if we had a federation of planets, we could have up to 36 members.
Okay, so this is a statistical probability of the existence of aliens in our galaxy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how many of them do you think are on our planet?
Well, that's a whole other story, Mrs. Fisher. This is the external world here. We're not going into the inner mind, Philip K. Dick, inner becomes the outer.
Oh, okay. We're talking about the science of real aliens.
Yeah, we're talking about...
This is out there. This is like the way that we predicted how many people were going to be affected by the pandemic. We just came up with a mathematical model and said millions of people will die. Now we're coming up with the mathematical model and saying 36 alien species exist in our galaxy.
We're silly monkeys. What can I say? it doesn't stop us from trying to figure stuff out that's way beyond us. I mean, that's just our nature. Yeah, I guess it's admitting that we don't really know. I guess would be
it's using our numbers to
no one really
give our imagination some parameters of what reality might look like.
Yeah. Yeah. How many sun-like stars are there, first of all? We ask smart questions. Well, first thing you do, we want aliens that kind of look like us. Right? So what do we got?
We breathe air.
Certain kind of star. We live on a certain kind of planet. Water's
certain
liquid.
Temperature range.
Water's liquid here, so only so many planets where the water's liquid. And they live in what they call the Goldilocks zones around other excesses. And so, we start figuring it out, start looking at that. And this estimate, 36, is the number of potential planets. They even have guesses as to which ones they might be.
Mm.
Like Kepler 452b.
Where are we here? I want to go to this article.
I think this question will really reach a crescendo next year.
This question,
yeah, and
about
whether or not
many...
there is life on other planets. For
why?
Real.
What happens next year?
We have a new rover that's going to Mars, and it's actually going to look for life and any signs of life that might exist, specifically for biological life as we know it. And if we find anything on Mars, anything at all, even fossils, then we'll know we're not the only life for sure.
In our solar system.
Yeah, in the solar system, if not the universe, because we haven't seen anything from anywhere else yet. DNA and all that will help a lot in analysis for that.
Be right back.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I wanted to mention Station M.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Station M?
Never heard of Station M.
Okay, we've been talking about Mars and outer space and other locations. Well, this is right off the coast of California, right near us, called Station M, run by Mbari.
Oh, really? Mbari, I've heard of. That's Station M?
Deep Sea Research Station here in the Monterey Bay area. And Station M is... there, the closest thing we have to an alien observation laboratory.
That's right. If you want to go to space, start in the sea.
Under the ocean. You want to see aliens, just go down 2.5 miles is where Station M is located. And it's the only deep sea site in the world where scientists have conducted long-term continuous measurements of the life forms and the sea floor. What's going on the sea floor, the deep seabed. And they were looking at the ecosystem there, you know, what creatures live there and what they eat, how they affect the gases in the ocean there, especially the carbon on the seafloor, the consumption of organic carbon by deep sea animals and all the microbes down there. And they've been down there for like 3 decades now, just off the coast here, studying the ocean, satellites, research ships, trawlers, human submarines. Alvin is probably one of the most famous ones. ROVs of all kinds. A rover on the floor, on the seabed, fish traps, sediment traps, respirometers, you know, looking at how much oxygen is being consumed where. Time-lapse cameras collecting all their information down there. 30 years of robots in the abyss. I just wanted to give a shout out to them. Hopefully some of them listen to our station on occasion. This laboratory has instruments that operate 24/7, and actual people only need to visit it once a year to get the data from Station M.
And can't get it wirelessly?
They do. Some of it you can't. Absolutely. It's changed our understanding of the deep seabed. They now know there's a lot that goes on down there. It's not a static thing. There's physical conditions are changing, and there are whole biological communities that can change dramatically. Very quickly, sometimes only in days, sometimes over decades. They've also been very interested in looking at how what goes on down there, how that relates to what's going on near the sea surface, like populations of algae or gelatinous animals will consume the nutrients and food in the surface waters, and then they die and they sink down to the bottom. And that blizzard of detritus coming down is a feast for these deep seafloor organisms down there that are literally manna from heaven for them, just drifting down.
Just rains from above.
It allows them to be happy and reproduce and become bigger seafloor communities by having this, you know, algae bloom up above that created more food for them, for the creatures that it fed.
Sure.
And they have feast-famine cycles. They've been looking at how that works. And like we have had this thing called the sea cucumber. At one point, they were rare in the 1990s, and then the sea cucumbers off the coast here became really abundant, and then they just disappeared entirely. Why? What happened to the sea cucumbers? Others have been consistent the whole time. It's a kind of a stage for, you know, when we go to Mars and we explore other planets, what we're doing just to study what's right here and all the tools that we're using for that can be extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess there's been a new publication called the Deep Sea Research that is publishing 16 of their research papers.
Yeah, and that's the important thing.
They're culminating some.
You could read all about this stuff. I can barely introduce it to you, but if you want to know about ecosystems and especially right off the coast here, It's right there. 16 volumes, I think. Massive amount of them.
16 research papers. Yeah. Deep sea research. And Ambari, I know, is very, you're very fond of Ambari. You've been out there a couple of times.
I was out there with Rachel Hager, a little school class. And we had to learn about what the kids are learning about underwater exploration and stuff. And I highly recommend getting a tour if you ever get a chance to get out there. I knew some of the folks there. Just kind of fun.
Are they related to the, connected to the Monterey Aquarium?
Yes, they are, yeah. They're like the research arm of the aquarium, my understanding.
Yeah, because they have, you can actually see remotely with their remote video, one of their deep divers out there.
From I think Ambari stands for Monterey yes. Bay Aquarium
oh, really?
Research Institute. Yeah.
Yeah, they have their own facility up to the double stacks, you know, the power plant.
Yeah.
And Moss Landing. Fascinating area, and definitely interesting to know all this is going on just off the coast of where we live. So, Bobby, you sent me a link this week on questions and answers with Dr. C. Halt, and I had a chance to listen to some of that.
Oh, the MedCram doctor.
The latest MedCram download, right. Really fast. Intro, the N95 sterilization, high fructose. Well, your outline was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'll just quickly go through those, but
yeah.
I think, you know, every Sunday he has a Q&A, and he goes through all the things that he's discovered. And
now, he's an emergency doc, right? Dr. C. Halt?
Schwelt. Yeah, Dr. Schwelt. Mm-hmm. Roger Schwelt. He's in Redlands, and he also teaches at UC Irvine, and he actually came from Loma Linda University. Mm-hmm. So he's in the front lines. You know, he has to don and doff these PPEs every day, and he's in contact and trying to save the lives of these COVID patients.
He's actually seeing real COVID patients and what's going on with
yes.
them.
And so he's on all the different protocols out there, and he's discovered some really interesting findings himself. And the most interesting he found was that just by putting the patients that are about to be put on a ventilator, like they stop, they can't get enough oxygen. He did something very simple. He just says, you prone their bodies so that they're actually lying down on their stomach. And they, all of a sudden, their oxygen levels start going back to normal. You know, instead of,
really?
Let's say, yes.
Just by lying on your stomach?
Just by lying on your stomach. And the way he explained it is, when you're on your back, a lot of the fluids just settle on the backside of your lungs toward your spine, right? And that's the most effective area to get oxygen. And so if you flip over and lie on your stomach, you can actually get much more oxygen into your system. This actually prevents them from going to go onto a ventilator. That was a very simple trick. You just do that for a couple hours and all of a sudden their oxygen levels come back dramatically.
Wow.
And then he also said that high fructose corn syrup and sweeteners actually increase your risk of oxidative stress, and so will put you into this state where you have to go to the ICU or you have to be put on a ventilator. And so he's saying, he definitely explains exactly the pathway that causes this. And so that's why the United States had such a high rate, because we eat too much sugar here, I guess. And it puts you in a state where your immune system just can't respond correctly. So he's saying that. And then he was talking, this was on Sunday, and he has a new one out today. He talks about the thing that they discovered in the UK, but he was talking about, there's a protocol called MMath Plus. It's Western Virginia Medicine, and where they actually use these steroids to actually reduce the probability of getting thrombosis and actually stopping your own immune system. So he recommends that. He talks about, well, let's say you do get in the hospital. Can you shop around? How do you know that you're going to the right hospital and you're going to get the best treatment, let's say, if you do get to this very bad point.
He helps you through the navigation of those issues?
Yeah, and he says the most important thing is the hospital pharmacy. It's like, does the hospital pharmacy have access to remdesivir or these steroids, or what do they have and how quickly can you get them? Or does the hospital have access to this convalescent plasma?
Yeah, which would be nice it seems like it works for quite a few.
And he says it's changed. A couple of months ago, it would take maybe a week for him to get the convalescent plasma, but now in 2 hours, he gets a response. He emails the blood banks around his area, and within 2 hours, they'll tell you whether they have this plasma for that person because it's based on your blood type, right?
Ah, okay. All right.
And he's saying within a day, you can get this plasma. And so he says he can treat people much faster than a couple months before.
Huh. That's in Redlands?
In Redlands, in Southern California. Yeah, that's where he's located.
Yeah, so those are the kind of questions I guess you can find out about from your local health providers if they have things like convalescent plasma.
He's really on the cutting edge of things. He says he throws the kitchen sink at his patients. So he gives them what he has right now is remdesivir, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, and N-acetylcysteine, NAC. He says his patients are doing quite well on this.
No hydroxychloroquine, no?
You know, the FDA just pulled hydroxychloroquine.
I heard about that, you know.
And we were wondering if that wasn't connected to something we reported on very early on about it being similar to an aquarium cleaner chemical that
people were taking,
mistaking.
Industrial versions of the same chemical.
Yeah, that was the sulfate version, and you want the phosphate version, or there's a different version of that. But anyway, you don't want to drink the sterilizer for your aquarium pool.
Right.
You
know?
Not good.
Yeah, if you're going to take anything, you really want to work with a professional and an expert who knows how it works and what the protocol is.
Yeah, and MedCram is really good for that.
Helpfully.
Yeah,
I really like this medicine. In Q&A with Dr. Schwelt, is that what his name is?
Schwelt.
Schwelt. S-E-H-E-U-L-T. We have a link on that, question and answers on COVID-19 with Dr. Schwelt at drfutureshow.com/links. Okay, thanks for that update, Babby. Really appreciate it. We're going to talk about some citizen scientist stuff in the next quarter. So, see you after the break.
Yeah, running down a dream that never would come to me. Working on a mystery, going wherever it leads. Running down a dream.
Okay, this might be kind of fun if you're the kind of person that likes to look at pictures and see what's in them and label them. NASA needs your help, citizen scientists, with mapping the surface of Mars, because they eventually want to create driving rovers like Curiosity around the planet a little bit easier. They want to have a better understanding of the lay of the land.
They're trying to do the Google map from the Mars rover point of view.
Except
it's not Google.
So they have...
It's NASA.
NASA, yes. They have an algorithm called SPOC, like in Mister. This stands for Soil Property and Object Classification. And it labels different types of Martian terrain, like boulders and sand, and it creates maps by which the rover driver can then use for navigating the vehicle. But the map is kind of rough. It needs refining. They need to know where all the boulders and stuff are. So they need to train them, the autonomous vehicles, with all the information, much like we're training autonomous cars to know about road signs and traffic lights and pedestrians and et cetera. It's a deep data set and deep learning. And the algorithm needs all this information in order to navigate in real time.
Now, what comes to my mind, wasn't there a giant windstorm, dust storm on Mars that lasted about a year?
Well, it might have changed a few road signs.
Doesn't that make doing a map of the trail a little bit more irrelevant?
No, not irrelevant. Maps are never irrelevant, Mrs. Future. They just need updating.
Okay.
It's a constant update process. And so for that, they have a tool that the public can use called the AI for Mars tool. AI for Mars, with a letter 4. And you can go to our links page and access that, AI for Mars. And you can then become part of the team that gets thousands of pictures of the terrain on Mars. And you've got to label what you see. You've got to label things as sand, soil, bedrock, big rocks.
Oh, okay. So this is kind of like a giant CAPTCHA where you're going to be given a bunch of pictures from Curiosity Rover and you have to identify
them. That's sand. That's a rock. No, that's a human clavicle. No, that's not.
No human bones on Mars yet, as far as we know.
But if you're interested in potentially looking for weird artifacts, then this would be a chance for you to be in the front row seat for doing that. Assuming they would send you the ones that had anything interesting on them. That's the AI for Mars project, and you'll help our rovers navigate on Mars. And hey, before long, I'm sure maybe even Disney might have an Imagineer cart that you can actually drive.
All right. Virtual rover coming right up.
Yeah. Science and entertainment here. Their idea is not to replace real drivers, as they'll still be required for more complex stuff, but we'll have more autonomous vehicles that do the tedious parts of the driving so we can, us humans, can focus on the more interesting stuff. Hmm. New inventions. I thought it was really cool what was being done in archaeology with the exploration of an entire Roman city revealed without any digging at all. Digging at all. A whole city. Archaeologists revealed an entire Roman city without any digging. It could revolutionize the study of old cities and old settlements. The University of Cambridge and Ghent succeeded in mapping a complete Roman city called Falerii Novi in Italy using, says the key here, advanced ground-penetrating radar.
There's a really great picture here. And it looks like just a satellite shot of a farm. Uh-huh. And then part of it has been rendered in black and white and appears to be like a map of some buildings and roads. And apparently this is an area that's a little bit smaller than the city of Pompeii.
My understanding is that it was relocated. There were people that the Romans had conquered and they relocated them to this location.
Oh, yeah? This is a resettlement camp?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's give them the land over by the volcano.
Okay, what do we know? The archaeologists have discovered a bath complex, a market, a temple, a public monument, and the city's sprawling network of water pipes. And the ground-penetrating radar system that they used apparently looks at different depths and then reconstructs the architecture without having to dig.
And they've got it so that they can cover much more territory than ever possible with this technology before. It's become very portable. They have the ground-penetrating radar unit being pulled behind a little tractor they call the quad, and they're able to get an astonishing deep level of detail of the town. Sheer wealth of high-resolution maps. Also, I think what's interesting is that they can look at it from a time point of view. They can look at the city over hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And really looking at the depth of the bouncing of the waves, you can see materials and things that existed at various time frames.
And various depths.
At various depths, right.
So they have a picture here that apparently this town is called Falerii Novi. Mm-hmm. And it was a Roman settlement first occupied in 241 BC and was continuous until sometime in the medieval era around 700 AD. They can see some evidence where the ancient walls were, and then they also see some evidence where there are holes because people took the rocks from the ancient walls and left a gap.
Yeah. So that was probably the most impressive thing. I saw that technology being used for the first time on a History Channel show that was investigating this ranch in Utah where supposedly UFOs were seen. Mm. Pretty haunted place, apparently. And they're using ground-penetrating radar for looking for underground tunnels beneath the place to see if there's an alien base there or something. It was an interesting use for the technology. But I think this archaeology is probably more likely to be successful in their endeavors.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. They've got what they think of as a monument that maybe had some pillars all around, and they have a market area, some shops.
Yep, yeah, that whole little town. There you go. I have to dig in anything. Yeah. It's going to change the whole nature of what an archaeologist is.
Archaeologist, yeah. So much for your paintbrush to dig.
Yeah. I was also pleased to see a piece in the Chronicle this week on how Ansel Adams was a campus photographer for UC Santa Cruz.
Oh, I want to see this exhibit.
Wow.
Yeah, back in 1965, he was hired as an official photographer to document the very beginning of the campus on the hill here.
Right. So there's a picture of one of the first students in September of 1965.
Yeah, he's one of the most famous photographers in the world already when he came to do this. So from 6 years, from 1962 to 1968, Adams wandered the campus, and he made 485 gelatin silver prints from that exhibit. The book, I think, is available. It's called Seeds of Something Different, an Oral History of the University of California, Santa Cruz, edited by Irene Retty, Cameron Vanderskoff, and Sarah Rabkin, with his pictures. Two volumes, 925 pages, color and black and white images combined. Yeah, I'd like to see that.
There you go.
First printing sold out at $50 for the set.
So UCSC, as photographed by Ansel Adams. Beautiful.
Yeah, they're beautiful pictures.
Mm. Wow. The second printing will be introduced in a virtual event series that started last Wednesday, June 10th, and runs 4:30 to 6:30 every Wednesday through July 15th. And they'll be showing some of his pictures in that virtual event series of Ansel Adams photographs, part of the UC Santa Cruz Library's digital collection. Yeah, very cool. We've got some great artists. Ansel Adams doing our university. Wow.
Boy, registration day. It was just in September of 1965. There's basically a table set up on a dirt road across from the Red Barn where the parking stop is now. It was just a table and some people sitting there.
Yeah, wasn't it just a ranch at one point? Mm. That was before the hippies arrived.
It says it also contains collections of the Grateful Dead Archive and the Hunter S. Thompson collection.
At the university? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Serendipitously, I met the guy who was doing the Grateful Dead.
Oh, you know what? We are here in the last minute of our show. Wow, that went fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fun sharing all this with you folks, and thank you, Mrs. Future, and thank you, Bobby, for being part of our conversation today.
Yeah, so definitely go to the links page and look at all those links.
Yeah, we just barely touched on what we're covering, but there's so many amazing things happening besides all the darkness.
Yes, so slowly we return to semblance of normal. Be sure and look up, folks. There's still a beautiful life to live, even though there's so many things to be sad about.
Yes, methinks we're going to go out and at least appreciate the afternoon by the beach.
Yeah, get some sunshine, beach.
Yeah, my
it's
vitamin
windy
D.
Day.
Right?
Yeah, vitamin D.
All right. All right.
Enjoy.
That's
Thanks
it
again.
For now. Okay. Bye.